Israel's ownership, which further complicated the project's advancement.
The Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs has given a protest note to Kuwait's ambassador to Tehran over the country's one-sided statements on the Arash natural gas field, which Iran shares with its southwestern neighbor. Mohammad Ali Beik, an assistant to Iran's foreign minister and the head of the ministry's Persian Gulf Department, said, "Making one-sided claims in various statements and through media undoubtedly cannot be a step forward to resolve the issue and will not establish any rights for the party uttering such assertions." We also talked to Mohammad Sadegh Mehju, a senior energy expert. Mr. Mehju had more to say about the history of Arash and the dispute around it.
What is the Kuwaiti-Iranian dispute over the Arash gas field?
The Arash field was initially discovered in 1967 as an exploration block designated for petroleum exploration. Arash, a joint exploration block, is situated close to the Esfandiar field, which is shared among Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. It lies approximately 10 kilometers away from the Abu Zar and Surush fields. The ongoing dispute revolves around border claims. Using the 1982 Law of the Sea Convention, LOSC, in its argument, Kuwait asserts full ownership of the field. Conversely, we contend that the border was established prior to the Islamic Revolution, entitling us to at least 30% of the field. However, Kuwait disagrees and continues to make statements opposing our claim.
Tehran has frequently proclaimed that a cooperative and respectful environment, rather than one-sided assertions, could lead to an agreement on the matter. Otherwise, the region has to prepare itself for yet another unnecessary tension.
What is Iran's position?
I believe that Tehran has taken a rational approach so far. The Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs has maintained an open door to diplomacy. Tehran has consistently advocated for negotiations to achieve a peaceful resolution that benefits both parties.
The dispute over Arash dates back to the 1960s when Iran and Kuwait were granted overlapping offshore concessions for the field, which has been called a treasure under the sea.
Mr. Hamidreza Salehi is the Director General of Federation of Iranian Energy Export Industries.
As you know, Iran has numerous shared fields with neighboring countries in the region. The largest joint field is with Qatar, known as South Pars, which significantly contributes to the country's gas production. There are several oil and gas fields that are shared with our neighboring countries. Among these fields is Arash, which has been a subject of dispute. As a member of the private sector, we'd like to invest in the field for future generations, albeit in a peaceful cooperation with the rest of the region.
Iran assigned rights to the Anglo-Iranian oil company while Kuwait gave its share to Royal Dutch Shell, leading to overlapping claims in the northern part of the reservoir. The two concessions overlapped in the northern part of the field. According to Reuters, the Arash field reserves are estimated at 1 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, of which 200 billion cubic feet are likely to be extracted immediately, in addition to over 310 million barrels of oil. These figures are of significant importance to the Kuwaiti side, as considering Kuwait's natural gas reserves, which do not exceed 35 trillion cubic meters, the hydrocarbon value of the field could increase Kuwait's reserves by 30%. Mr. Hamid Hosseini is a senior energy expert and chief executive of the monthly Dunyaye Enerji, or the World of Energy.
What is the significance of the Arash field?
The Arash field holds approximately 570 billion cubic meters of gas and contains nearly 310 million barrels of oil, making it a valuable resource for countries like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, which have few, if any, gas fields. The Arash field holds even greater significance. as they rely on gas imports for their domestic needs, refineries, and other purposes. They have a vested interest in accessing the Arash field's resources as soon as possible. That is while Iran is not in a rush, as it has an abundance of gas fields within its territory.
As for Iran, nearly 40% of Arash field is located in Iranian waters. In 2001, the National Iranian Oil Company drilled an exploratory well to determine the amounts of its reserves. Kuwait then threatened to take the issue to international arbitration, and following the Kuwaiti emir's visit to Tehran during the Khatami administration, Tehran stopped exploration and removed the platform built at the site. Mr. Hosseini added that for Iran, having good relationships with neighbors is very important, and the country is not happy to escalate tensions in the region for energy.
Iran was the first country in the region to drill the first oil well. Iran was also the pioneer in conducting marine explorations to discover oil and gas fields in the region. The Arash oil field was founded in the 1960s by a Japanese company working under the commission of the National Iranian Oil Company. Prior to the Islamic Revolution, Iran had discovered the field and chosen the name Arash for it. Today, Iran shares nearly 30 joint oil and gas fields with countries like Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Iraq. The Arash field is just one example. The South Pars gas field, the largest in the world, is shared with Qatar, and despite its significant size, representing over 15% of the world's gas reserves, Iran has accepted Qatar's two-thirds ownership. This demonstrates Iran's honesty and commitment to maintaining good relations with its neighbors. In fact, maintaining positive relationships with neighboring countries has always been a priority for Iran.
Iran's drilling and then its decision to halt it, in fact, came a year after Saudi Arabia and Kuwait had jointly started exploration and development activities on the field without Tehran's knowledge. In 2016, Iranian media reported that Saudi Arabia and Kuwait had formed the Al-Khafji joint operations to develop the field on a 50-50 joint venture without any right for Iran.
I believe that fostering better political interactions among the involved nations could have allowed all parties to reap the benefits of the Arash field more effectively. The strained relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia negatively impacted the project's progress, ultimately leading to a partnership between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia that excluded the Islamic Republic of Iran. Improved diplomatic relations among the three countries might facilitate a more inclusive and mutually beneficial approach to the development of the Arash field.
The Islamic Republic has strongly objected to the agreement, with officials saying the move is illegal as the boundaries of the field shared between the three countries have not yet been established. Tehran has repeatedly called for a border demarcation agreement to determine its right to exploit part of the field.
The Arash field situation could pose a challenge to Iran's national integrity, and it necessitates a proactive and efficient collaboration among the involved countries. Establishing clear boundaries and fostering open communication can help mitigate such disputes. By working together and defining their respective territories, the involved parties can find a resolution that benefits all.
In March 2022, Saudi Arabia's energy minister signed a document with his Kuwaiti counterpart to develop the Arash Dora gas field to produce 1 billion standard cubic feet per day of gas and 84,000 barrels per day of condensates. Iran's Minister of Petroleum, Javad Oji, was quick to respond to his Saudi counterpart's announcement then, saying Tehran would soon begin drilling at the Arash field. Although we want to negotiate and cooperate for development of joint fields, unilateral measures will not prevent the implementation of the project, he said, after Kuwait and Saudi Arabia signed a document to build the offshore reservoir without Tehran's participation.
From March 2023 onwards, the debate over the Arash field has been under intense scrutiny. A joint committee comprising the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Geography Organization of the Armed Forces, and the Ministry of Oil has been assigned to analyze various aspects of the issue. They have made a number of decisions so far. The Ministry of Oil has explicitly stated its readiness for any potential outcomes. In a sense, Iran is ready to deliver a suitable response in the upcoming period if the opposing party insists on their current position.
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here, we'll go over some important news headlines. Iran says a unilateral claim to Arash gas field will create no rights for claimants. Iran has repeatedly announced its principled stance on the issue based on international law, underlined Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani. Shana writes, the spokesman made the remarks during his weekly press conference in reaction to a statement issued by the Ministerial Council of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, which claims only Saudi Arabia and Kuwait have the rights to exploit the field known as Al Dura in the two Arab states. We have emphasized the continuation of technical and legal talks with Kuwait officials, he pointed out. Unilateral claim on Arash gas field creates no rights for claimants, Iran says. Tehran Times writes, Iran has repeatedly announced its principled stance on the issue based on international law. The country tries to create a positive and constructive atmosphere to develop its relations with neighbors, refuting such issues in one-sided statements as not acceptable. Iran issues fresh warning against Kuwait over Arash gas field row. Iran says it believes in integrated and joint extraction with Kuwait and Saudi Arabia from the disputed Arash gas field in the Persian Gulf, warning Tehran will start drilling in the field if Kuwait does so. Iran News Daily writes, the Iranian Vice President for Legal Affairs, Mohammad Dehghan, reiterated on Thursday that the ownership dispute should be resolved through dialogue. Arash is an oil and gas field and part of it belongs to us. We do not have a maritime border with Kuwait, but we discovered the field and drilled rigs there many years ago without taking advantage of it. So, we won't create tensions with our neighbors, Dehghan clarified. The Arash gas field dispute, a thorny issue in Persian Gulf politics. IUVM Press writes, the Arash oil gas field serves as a poignant symbol of the intricate geopolitical dance unfolding among Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. Over time, what began as a cooperative effort has degenerated into a contentious focal point, sparking debates surrounding resource distribution and territorial delineation. Nestled within this shared expanse lies the Arash gas field, boasting a substantial storage capacity of 1 trillion cubic feet alongside an estimated 42 million barrels of crude oil. Thank you for joining us in this section. I invite you to go back to the main narrative.
In last August, Tehran officially invited Kuwaiti Foreign Minister Salem Abdullah al-Jaber al-Sabah to de-escalate tensions.
It is important to highlight our strong connections with Kuwait. For instance, Iranians have had a significant presence in Kuwait for over a century. The people of both nations have enjoyed meaningful interactions over the years. Additionally, there have been numerous joint investments in both Iran and Kuwait. With the rest improvement in relations between Tehran and Riyadh, we aim to achieve a similar level of collaborative investment with Saudi Arabia. I believe that promoting cooperation rather than competition is the best way towards a brighter future.
However, the Supreme Council of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council torpedoed de-escalation efforts at the end of its 44th summit in Doha, Qatar, claiming that the entirety of the Arash gas field lied within Kuwait's maritime territories. The council also said the ownership of natural resources in the submerged area adjacent to the Saudi-Kuwaiti divided area, including the entire gas field, is exclusively a joint ownership between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. According to the statement, both have exclusive rights to exploit the natural resources in that area, adding, the council firmly rejected any claims of rights by any other party in this field or the submerged area adjacent to the demarcated area between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait.
Has there been any attempts to reach a deal?
تا اونجایی که من اطلاع دارم تا الان در حقیقت طرف کویتی و عربستانی
As far as I know, the Kuwaitis and Saudis have been insisting on their position. At the same time, delegations from Iran and Kuwait have been engaging in back and forth discussions, yet so far, no substantial agreement has been reached. I hope that both Kuwaitis and Saudis refrain from adopting more controversial positions to prevent escalating tensions among these three neighboring nations. I believe that direct negotiations would be beneficial.
The Council statement came after both Saudi Arabia and Kuwait announced in July that there was no room for negotiations with Iran regarding the Arash Dora gas field in the Persian Gulf. That's while historical records of the past 60 years show no Saudi role in negotiations between Iran and Kuwait to determine the maritime borders around the Arash field and how to exploit its resources, meaning Riyadh's push to stake out a share has started only since 2000. In reaction to the statement issued by the Supreme Council of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, National Iranian Oil Company head Mohsen Khojasemir announced that Iran was ready to begin drilling in the Arash field. He said once the necessary conditions are met, drilling operations in the Arash field will begin.
Currently, we have 26 joint fields. What if we embark on a joint venture with Saudi and Kuwait companies? They can help us with our own fields, not just the joint ones. The private sector in Iran is open to foreign investment to enhance gas extraction from our own fields. With their support, we can convert gas into LNG and export it with added value. There is significant potential for collaboration in this aspect. If we manage the situation in Arash peacefully, we can consider expanding our cooperation further. After all, we have many projects in Iran worth hundreds of billions of dollars that our neighbors can take part as investors.
For years, Iran and Kuwait have held talks over their disputed maritime border area, practically with no success. Why has the dispute remained unresolved?
There are two approaches to addressing the Arash field ownership issue. According to Iran's proposed method, it should be considered a joint field for shared use among the involved countries. However, the Kuwaitis advocate for a second approach, which would result in the field being predominantly under their ownership. Unfortunately, there is no universally accepted method to resolve this dispute. I would like to draw your attention to this point. Politicizing the case could lead to negative consequences for all parties involved. We have witnessed the politicization of Iran's share in the Caspian Sea, which has turned the issue into a complex and challenging situation for everyone. To prevent a similar destiny for the Arash field, I would like to ask the Kuwaiti authorities to refrain from politicizing the matter.
Attempts to revive negotiations have failed. Kuwait's oil minister Saad al-Barak was quoted on July 27 as saying his country would begin drilling and production at the Arash gas field without waiting for a demarcation deal with Iran. This prompted Iran's oil minister to counter, saying Tehran may pursue work at the field without an agreement. Javad Oji said, Iran will pursue its rights and interests regarding exploitation and exploration of the field if there is no desire for understanding and cooperation.
Is there any peaceful solutions to the dispute?
A potential solution to this dispute could involve finding an impartial mediator to facilitate negotiations between Iran and Kuwait. OPEC, with its Secretary General being from Kuwait, might not be the most suitable choice due to potential conflicts of interest. Alternative options for mediation could include the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, as they have experience in resolving international disputes. Another possibility is enlisting the help of influential individuals from both countries who could act as intermediaries. Another approach could be to assign a third party to develop the Arash field and distribute the profits fairly between Iran and Kuwait. This way, both sides can avoid a direct involvement in a development project, so it could reduce tensions and foster a more cooperative atmosphere between the two nations.
The dispute between Iran and Kuwait over the Arash gas field is a complex and long-standing issue that has yet to be resolved. The competing claims, historical context, and strategic importance of the field make it a challenging matter for both countries to navigate. But the dispute for Iran is more than a row about an energy reserve. Iran shares 28 oil and gas fields with its neighbors, which constitutes the country's 20% of oil and 30% of gas reserves. And Arash is just one of them. What is at stake in the first place is the territorial integrity of the Islamic Republic. Tehran knows that a step backward might send wrong signals to the intruders. In a similar case like that of Arash, the United Arab Emirates has been laying claims of sovereignty on Iran's three islands of Greater Tomb, Lesser Tomb, and Abu Musa, which are located in the Persian Gulf. These three islands are of strategic importance due to their location in the Persian Gulf and their proximity to important shipping lanes. Despite all historical and legal documents that show they belong to Iran, Abu Dhabi still has claims over them. Iran will never give in to such baseless claims over its territory. Such claims will just lead to more tensions in the region already known for its volatility.
It is essential to maintain diplomatic language when discussing the Arash field ownership issue. Claiming that Iran has no share in the field is neither accurate nor politically correct. Historically, Iran discovered the Arash field in 1967, but chose not to unilaterally exploit it, recognizing it as a joint field. This decision demonstrates Iran's commitment to respecting the rights of other nations. When the field was discovered, Iran was the dominant power in the Persian Gulf, and it had the capability to seize control of the field as well as other fields without facing any serious objection, but the country never did that.
Over the past year, Iran has been dealing with the dispute over Arash with deference for the sake of a successful rapprochement deal with Riyadh. But any aggressive push by Kuwait and Saudi Arabia is not going to be tolerated for long in Tehran.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Till next time, take care.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In the United States, the Border Patrol chief has warned the migrant crisis is a national security threat and says his biggest fear is not the 1 million people apprehended so far this year, but the 140,000 known gotaways. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens has called the situation at the southern border with Mexico a national security threat, expressing concern about tens of thousands of migrants who have evaded apprehension and entered the United States surreptitiously over the past 5 months. Jason Owens said Border Patrol is closing in on recording 1 million apprehensions of migrants in between ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border in the 2024 fiscal year, which started last October. For the third consecutive year, his agency is on track to record 2 million apprehensions by the time the fiscal year ends at the end of September, Owens said. That number is a large number, but what's keeping me up at night is the 140,000 known gotaways. But Owens asked, why are they risking their lives and crossing in areas where we can't get to? Why are they hiding? What do they have to hide? And what are they bringing in? What is their intent? Where are they coming from? We simply don't know the answers to those questions. Those things, for us, are what represent the threat to our communities. The situation, Owens added, amounts to a national security threat. Border security is a big piece of national security, added, and if we don't know who is coming into our country and we don't know what their intent is, that is a threat, and they're exploiting a vulnerability that's on our border right now. However, Owens agreed that the vast majority of migrants coming into the United States border are good people. I think the migrants that we encounter that are turning themselves in, yes, I think they absolutely are, by and large, good people. I wish they would choose the right way to come into our country and not start off on the wrong foot by breaking our laws. While a very small amount of these apprehended at the southern border are serious criminals, such as those convicted of murder or other serious crimes, Owen said most migrants are surrendering themselves to Border Patrol agents to escape poverty or violence in their home countries. They're coming across because they're either fleeing terrible conditions or they're economic migrants looking for a better way of life, he said. Customs and Border Protection, the CBP statistics show a tiny fraction of migrants processed by Border Patrol have criminal records in the United States or other countries that share information with American officials. And an even smaller percentage have been convicted of serious crimes. Available data and studies also suggest that migrants in the United States illegally do not commit crimes at a higher rate than native-born Americans. Still, top law enforcement officials, including FBI Director Christopher Wray, have voiced concerns about criminal actors, including potential terrorists, exploiting the unprecedented levels of migration along the U.S. southern border with Mexico over the past 3 years. In both fiscal years, 2022 and 2023, Border Patrol reported over 2 million apprehensions of migrants who crossed the southern border illegally, both all-time highs. Jason Owens said the extraordinary flow of people into the United States is mainly driven by cartels. Asked if cartels were setting the rules of engagement at the southern border, Owens said, yes, they absolutely are. The New York Post has also covered this same story and tells us more. U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens said the migrant crisis has become a serious national security threat, as terrorists may be slipping across the border with Mexico and smugglers dictate the flow into the United States. They dictate what the flow is going to look like, and we respond to it, Owens said in an interview on CBS's Face the Nation program on Sunday. He said, we try and get out in front of it and deny them the ability to use these areas. But at the end of the day, there's over 1,900 miles of border with Mexico. Under the Biden administration, the United States has endured record levels of migrants pouring across the southern border with Mexico, including thousands who claim asylum and are then released into the country. Border Patrol has reported 1,151,000 encounters at the southern border, according to the most recent tally of numbers through the 2024 fiscal year. The prior year saw 2,475,000 cases, according to the agency. Owens fretted that there could be terrorists and other dangerous people slipping through the system. "That number is a large number, but what's keeping me up at night is the 140,000 known gotaways. It's not part of that," he said, referring to the official count, "and that's just what we know." "That is a national security threat. Border security is a big piece of national security, and if we don't know who is coming into our country, and we don't know what their intent is, that is a threat. They're exploiting a vulnerability that's on our border right now." The border chief noted that most of the encounters are with individuals who are turning themselves in and are fleeing dire economic conditions at home. "That doesn't make them bad people, it's just that they're not being respectful of the laws that we've established as a country," he said. Jason Owens stressed that there are dangerous people buried in that population that do pose a risk to the United States. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. The US Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens has said the crisis at the southern border with Mexico is a national security threat that keeps him awake at night, in a new interview during which he spelled out the danger posed by millions of illegal migrants who've entered the country in recent years. The US Border Patrol is mere days away from hitting 1 million apprehensions of migrants in fiscal year 2024, which began for the US government last October. "What's keeping me at night awake is the 140,000 gotaways," Owens said. "The number of migrants who have sneaked into the country undetected since last October." But he asked, "What are they hiding? What do they have to hide? What are they bringing in? What is their intent? Where are they coming from?" Owens explained are the primary concerns of the US Border Patrol about the gotaways, whose backgrounds and locations are virtually unknown to the US government. "We simply don't know the answers to those questions. Those things for us are what represent a threat to our communities," he said. Jason Owens said his department is on track to record some 2 million apprehensions by the time the fiscal year ends in September. The US Border Patrol chief said border security is a big piece of national security, and the illegal migrants being smuggled into the country are exploiting a vulnerability facing the nation at present time. He said migrants who've made their way into the United States this year have come from at least 160 different countries, some of which are many continents away. Routes from Europe and Asia lead to the Darien Gap in Panama, a popular starting point for smugglers leading large groups of migrants north through Central America and eventually into the United States.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. Well, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start off this episode with this question, Sheikh. Since we think that taking tablets or pills for treatment is not regarded as eating or drinking, or as you mentioned in one of the earlier programs, as a supplement, for example, in the common view, would taking those pills and tablets void the fast?
It definitely impacts the fast. It affects the fast because taking tablets through the mouth is a kind of eating. Though in common view it is not considered eating, but it is a kind of taking. Just as you take food, you also take pills. And taking tablets through the mouth does invalidate the fast.
Mm. During the month of Ramadan, a husband or a man had sexual intercourse with his wife with her consent. What's the rule concerning this?
Well, having sexual intercourse during the month of Ramadan is one of the invalidating agents, and it's strictly forbidden for a man and his wife to engage in sexual activities which result in, for example, in ejaculation, or, for example, having the intercourse itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it is forbidden. And if it both of them engage in a consensual sexual activity and it results to having sex or ejaculation, the fast becomes void.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be necessary for both parties for both the individuals to give the qadha of their fast and also give a penalty, which is called in legal parlance. It is called actually kafara. So they have to give kafara, which is, you know, to fast for 60 days and feed 60 people, because if they do it deliberately, this kafara becomes payable.
Mm.
And of course, not only kafara, but also they have to give the qadha of the fast as well.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's have a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program. I just wanted to have you a question quite related to this, but let's leave it after the break. Stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulubana bil Qur'an.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Sheikh Javid, before the break, I asked you a question regarding sexual intercourse, which you said that, well, obviously it requires a penalty,
yeah,
right?
A kafara
and
both.
Another, yes, both actually. But what if the couple have a foreplay, basically, all right,
yes,
before their sex, and without, they don't come to the orgasm or the ejaculation of the semen in the month of Ramadan while they are fasting? Does this invalidate their fasting?
Well, foreplay in and of itself does not make the first void, as long as the both of them are confident that it will not result in ejaculation. You know, there are many other sexual activities like kissing, hugging, and, you know, touching each other actually. All of these practices are allowed, as long as they are confident that these acts of sexual activity do not lead to some kind of orgasm or some kind of ejaculation for both parties. So the fast will not be rendered void.
I see. You talked about the invalidating agent for fast. Would you tell us about the all of those invalidating agents? What does invalidate fast?
Yeah, there are a number of things which invalidate the fast. And of course, there are 9 things which invalidate the fast. One of them is eating, the other one is drinking, and then the sexual intercourse is strictly forbidden. It is also one of the invalidating agents. We discussed it. And then an act that causes semen to come out, like, for example, masturbation, which is a grave sin, it is strictly forbidden. And inshallah, maybe if we make time, we will discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
And then each of these invalidating agents that I just enumerate here will have their own, has its own details conditions which can be discussed in another episode, inshallah.
Mm-hmm.
And then failing to make ghusl for menses, for janaba, for nifas until the morning adhan. You know,
mm-hmm.
if a woman is in the state of janaba or in the state of monthly period or maybe in nifas, and she deliberately delays the ghusl which is required to be performed before dawn, so it's also one of the invalidating agents. And then enema, which is to insert some kind of liquid into the rectum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I should say also that, for example, if someone insert something hot, like something, for example, give the example of suppository.
Mm-hmm.
If it is inserted in the rectum because of the temperature, some people might have high temperature, so it is sometimes becomes necessary, that will not affect the fast. But if liquid is inserted through the anus, it will definitely make the fast void. So this was enema was the fifth one, and then the sixth one is vomiting. If a person deliberately throws up and vomits something which is in his stomach, then it will make the fast void. Number 7, to tell a lie regarding God and Prophet and the infallible Imams as an obligatory precaution, ascribe something lie. Ascribe or tell some a lie regarding God, okay? It will affect the fast as an obligatory precaution. His Eminence exercises precaution in this regard.
This was Prophet and Imams.
The Prophet and the infallible Imams, and of course God. Okay, if you said something that God said and said such and such thing, well, God never said that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you ascribe something false to God, well, God never said that, okay? If the fast becomes void. The same is the case with the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and also the infallible Imams and Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullahi alayha. If you ascribe something false to them, the fast becomes void as an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
So number 8.
Let's leave it up to the after the break. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back, continue our program and continue the invalidating agents of fasting after the break. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including practical laws of Islam, frequently asked questions, comparative fatwa, and newly asked questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting in general, and in particular, Sheikh Javid, you were talking about the invalidating agents.
Yeah, we were talking about ascribing false things to God, the Prophet, infallible Imams, and as I said, and is based on the fatwa of all the religious authorities, ascribing false things to those noble figures, the Prophet and the Imams, and also God, and the Lord of the creation, is not permissible under any circumstances. It will affect the fast as an obligatory precaution. Now, the eighth one is allowing thick dust to reach the throat.
Yes.
For example, if you know there is dust somewhere, for example, in a room, and and you enter that room, it's so dusty that you cannot see things. It's thick dust.
Yes.
And when it comes to thick dust, you should see what the common people consider the dust as thick. Mm-hmm. If in common view, it is called as thick dust,
yes,
then it becomes an invalidating agent, and this again is based on obligatory precaution. So for example, smoking also comes under the very category because it's a kind of let's say dust. It's not dust, but it's smoke going into something. It is something like dust, but it goes into your throat without you wanting to inhale it.
Yes.
So it is not permissible, and it will make the fast void as an obligatory precaution. Then there is the ninth thing, which is submerging the whole head under water. Submerging the head under water. We know that submerging means that you, for example, jump into the water, for example, a lake or a swimming pool, and all of your body is covered by water. You submerge and you immerse your head underwater. This immersion is not permissible while fasting. And it does not make any difference whether you are fasting, you are observing a wajib fast or a mustahab fast. It definitely makes your fast wide according to His Eminence, according to some of the religious authorities. There are, I said, this is a matter of dispute and controversy. Some scholars, including, for example, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, is of the view that submerging your head underwater, it does not affect your fast. So it's permissible to swim in the month of Ramadan and to dive underwater in the month of Ramadan, according to him. But according to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, one should avoid submerging. So, of course, swimming is permissible. And pouring water on your head is permissible. It does not affect, because normally when you pour water on your head, it does not make your fast void. You can pour your water on your head, and it's in common view, it's not considered to be submerging your head in water. If you want to stand under a waterfall, again, it's not considered to be a kind of immersion underwater. You just like you stand under a fountain, let's say the shower, you go and take a shower and the water comes on your head. Again, it's not considered to be submersion in the common view.
I see.
So ghusl, and of course the fast is not made void.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, as the host of this program. And on behalf of the rest of the crew, we wish you farewell and ask you to keep us in your du'as and remember us in this blessed month, Ramadan. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
More than 200 legislators from European countries which fund Israel militarily recently called for their countries to stop selling weapons to Tel Aviv, citing violations of international law in Israel's relentless bombardment of Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website New Arab has covered this story and tells us more. The European Union has been marred by deepening divisions over Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians of Gaza, which shows the world's most powerful bloc is fast decaying. The 5 months of no-holds-barred Israeli assault on the besieged territory has not only exposed the international community, but it has also laid bare deep fault lines in the European Union. The heads of the 27 European countries have limited themselves to issuing passive statements about sending humanitarian aid to Gaza, whilst refusing to make an unambiguous call for a complete ceasefire in Gaza or building pressure on the Israeli regime to end its military assault on Gaza. In its recent statement, the Council of Europe, after condemning the operations of Palestinian resistance movements and emphasizing Tel Aviv's so-called right to defend itself, called for unhindered access to humanitarian aid for the people of Gaza, including through humanitarian corridors. However, according to a report in Politico, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen angered the European Union's foreign policy team in an unusual move. Some 800 European Union staff also wrote a letter protesting that von der Leyen showed unjustified bias towards Tel Aviv. Ursula von der Leyen has been unequivocal and unapologetic about her support for the Israeli regime and the ongoing genocide of Palestinians in Gaza, which hasn't gone down well with some EU officials. She was one of the first Western leaders to visit the occupied Palestinian territories in October to give her stamp of approval to Netanyahu's war on Gaza. More recently, in von der Leyen's speech at the Hudson Institute in Washington, she again harped about the Zionist regime's right to defend itself, whilst completely ignoring the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. Commenting on the European Commission President's speech, a senior European Union official said, she expressed her personal views and presented an unbalanced view of EU's position on the situation in Gaza. According to some officials, Ursula von der Leyen's relationship with EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has become strained, and the crisis has heightened as the two of them have slightly different stances on Gaza. Last month, in an interview with the Spanish daily El País, Josep Borrell slammed the EU chief over her visit to the occupied Palestinian territories in October of last year, pointing to a deepening rift within the European bloc. Josep Borrell said, the trip by von der Leyen, with such an absolutely pro-Israeli stance, without representing anyone but herself in a matter of international politics, has had a high geopolitical cost for Europe. The Spanish newspaper El País in a separate report said Israel has been irked by the EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell because Borrell has situated himself on the Palestinian side. On the other hand, Michael Oren, a former Israeli envoy to the United States, said the EU foreign policy chief should not be allowed to set foot on the occupied Palestinian territories. These differences and divisions have even spread to other leaders of the alliance because the history of the European Union has shown that in times of crisis and when the bloc faces serious challenges, it cannot make comprehensive decisions and is not able to speak in one voice. The former Belgian Foreign Minister Mark Iskens, on the eve of the US-led international coalition's military attack on Iraq in 1990, said Europe is an economic giant but a political dwarf and a military worm. A clear demonstration of that has been the war between Russia and Ukraine, in which no initiative has been seen on the part of the Europeans to end the war. Europe has surrendered itself to the United States. Although the bloc has a unanimous voice on Ukraine, it has become a divided house on Gaza Strip. The Israeli genocide case at the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Netherlands, brought by South Africa, also drew attention to these deepening differences in the European Union. Germany had before the ICJ ruling said the genocide case lacked any basis and declared that it would intervene in the International Court of Justice's proceedings as a third party. Some other countries have welcomed the ICJ's ruling. The ceasefire resolution introduced by the United Nations Security Council and the UN General Assembly in recent months also laid bare these glaring differences and divisions within the European bloc. For example, on 26th of October last year, 8 EU countries voted in favour of a ceasefire in Gaza at the UN General Assembly, while 4 European countries voted against it. On 12th of December last year, in another vote, 17 European Union countries backed the truce arrangement, while 2 countries voted against it. Some other European Union member states, including France and Spain, were against it for different reasons. On the situation in the Red Sea, European Union member countries have not been on the same page. On 11th of January this year, only 8 countries, 3 of them EU members, Denmark, the Netherlands and Germany, signed a joint statement with the United States and Britain, justifying the airstrikes against Yemen. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a Belgian member of parliament who is among the more than 200 lawmakers who have signed a letter calling for an arms embargo on Israel, Europe risks any credibility to speak on Russia's special operations in Ukraine if it remains silent on Gaza. Simon